Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of April. Our guest this hour in a new report writes the low wages paid by businesses, including some of the largest and most profitable companies in the U.S., McDonald's and Walmart, are costing taxpayers nearly $153 billion a year. The problem of low wages and public cost extends far beyond the fast food industry. The report says 48% of home care workers rely on public assistance. In child care, it's 46%. Among part-time college faculty, some of the most highly educated workers in the country, it's 25%. To put it in the perspective of one human being, Denise Rush is a home health care worker in Durham and often works 7 days a week, returning home near midnight after her two teenagers have gone to bed. Her wages, $9.50 an hour, biweekly paycheck totals just over $700, and that's the cost of her monthly rent. There's little left over for other expenses, and she says it's a crazy dilemma. Do I pay the whole bill, or do I gas up the car to go to work? She receives coverage for children's health care from Medicaid, $300 a month in food stamps, but the paycheck falls quite short. This hour of the program, we'll talk about those low wages and what it is that can be done so people can work pretty hard and afford to put food on the table and afford a decent kind of living. Nothing fancy, a decent living. Our guest is Ken Jacobs, and Ken is chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education and co-author of the study titled The High Public Cost of Low Wages. His areas of specialization include healthcare coverage, the California budget, low-wage work, the retail industry, and public policy. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Ken. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Ken. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When I talk about the life of Denise and how hard she has to work and raise children and can't make ends meet, and she's working really hard, the thing that's really disturbing is not only her story, but the number of people in a number of occupations who are working very hard and just can't make it.
That's right. For tens of millions of Americans, their wages pay too low for them to meet basic needs on the amount they earn alone. And that's why we have now 3 out of 4 people who receive public assistance in the United States are in working families. That is, they work or have a family member who works. And as you mentioned how high that is in some of those occupations. You look at fast food workers, it's over 50% of fast food workers either themselves receive some form of public assistance or a family member does. And that's true even for full-time fast food workers, not just when we look at part-time workers.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what's happened with wages when we look at the 1970s and compare them with now.
Right. So if we look at the United States overall, wages have just, for the median wage, has just gone up 5% in real terms. That's inflation adjusted over the last 25 years. But if we look at low-wage workers, it's actually decreased. And this has been especially true if we look at just the last decade. Wages have either stagnated or declined for the bottom 70% of workers, with really the biggest drops in that bottom 30% of workers. So what we're seeing is a rise in or decline in middle-wage jobs, a rise in low-wage jobs, and some more highly paid jobs at the top, a real hollowing out of the middle class.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at where the growth is, I would imagine the number of jobs available in the home healthcare area where everybody, because everybody's getting older in this country, there will be more and more jobs and more very low-wage jobs.
That's right. When you look at what are the fastest-growing jobs in the United States, low-wage jobs top that, repeatedly top that list. And home care workers is one of the fastest-growing jobs in the United States. And it's important to note as we look at this, you know, what's happened over the last 25 years. And part of that story, of course, was the decline in manufacturing, and an important part of the story was the deunionization, the fact that in the late 1950s, we had 33% of the workforce in unions. Today, in the private sector, it's only 7%, and overall only 11%. And so that has reduced workers' bargaining power overall. But importantly, when we look in the last decade or a little bit more and say, okay, what's driving this drop in wages? It isn't a change in the industry mix and what and the mix of jobs. We're finding reductions in real wages, that's inflation-adjusted wages, within industries and within occupations. And what that really reflects is a decline in workers' bargaining power. And while with the economy heating up, we should see some wage growth at the bottom, we're not likely to see major changes getting us back to where we were, or even better, without some public policy intervention.
Mm-hmm. And did the result in bargaining power, the loss of power of unions, result in all of these drives in many states in the country to raise the minimum wage?
Right. So what's happened is, as unions have become weaker overall, what we're seeing is more of the things that unions used to produce and still do in some cases are being legislated. So we're seeing more and more push to increase the minimum wage, and of course unions have been a big part of the effort to do that. And that's true. We've got now over half the states have higher minimum wage than the federal government. And we're seeing cities raise the minimum wage. Chicago will be going up to $13 an hour, San Francisco and Seattle to $15 an hour. And we're seeing other cities and states look at things like paid sick days, addressing issues of unpredictable schedules for low-wage workers, because along with wages, one of the big issues for low-wage workers is many of them don't get their schedules till that very week that they're working, which makes it very difficult to go to school, care for a child, care for an elderly parent when you don't know what your work schedule is going to be.
Do you see at all in the not-too-distant future, Ken, a resurgence of interest and possibly formation of unions?
Well, I think that is a very important issue. Part of the problem that we've faced, I mean, if you survey people and ask that question, there is strong interest for people in joining unions. But we have a labor law today that makes it harder and harder for people to actually do so. And that has been one of the drivers we've seen in the last 25 years in terms of that hollowing out of the middle class and driving down unionization rates, is that today, under our current labor law, it is very, very difficult to form a union. And so part of what we're seeing now is these new kinds of organizing, like the fast food organizations. We saw last Wednesday the fast food workers' strikes around the United States, very large protests, and it wasn't just fast food workers, but workers from all of these low-wage industries coming together. And they're all sort of grappling forward in new kinds of organization. Their demand is for $15 an hour and a union, but they're working on creating some form of organization even before they're able to achieve collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, the profits of these companies like Walmart and McDonald's and others are pretty high these days, aren't they?
They are. Walmart's ran into a little more trouble recently, but yes, they profits are doing very well overall. The stock market is doing very well overall right now. I mean, if we go back again, talking about going back to the 1970s, productivity, or the late 1970s, productivity has increased significantly. What hasn't happened is that just wages and total compensation have not kept up with productivity. It used to be, and when I studied, took undergraduate economics in school, we were taught that wages rose with productivity, and that was true up until about the late 70s. And then what happened after that is the gains from increased output per worker stopped going to workers. And again, that reflects this disbalance of power.
Mm-hmm. I was really captivated by this story out of Seattle. I'm sure that you saw this as well, and actually we have him on the show tomorrow during this period, Dan Price. He's the business owner who decided that he was going to double the salary of his 120-person staff, so he took his fairly very large income and cut it way down and gave everybody double their salary. So everybody's making $70,000 a year. And it was such an incredibly uplifting story. They were all smiling. Maybe I can buy a house now. I have so much more security. And maybe this is too simplistic an understanding of the issue, but here was somebody who just took what was a very large salary for him and he thought it was too much. You know, does it take that kind of altruism or sense of fairness in order to turn these around? And were you as struck by that story as I was?
I was, and I think what it really highlights is there is no economic necessity for the level of income inequality that mm-hmm. we have right now. In fact, there's been quite a bit of research that shows that income inequality reduces growth rather than increases growth. The old story used to be, well, you have a choice between equity and growth, and the research is making it clear that large levels of income inequality can actually reduce growth and really distort an economy. But we have seen huge change overall in sort of what's the ratio of a CEO pay to your lowest wage worker pay, your average worker pay, and we're up to 300-1 now.
Wow.
In the United States. That is way overshadows what you see in the rest of the country. In Germany, for example, by law, you have worker representatives on the boards of corporations, and they are not allowed to operate just based on in their deliberations and considerations, it's not only profit, but the effect on the wider society. And you see very different outcomes. The German corporations are incredibly competitive around the world. They do very well. But what you do see is a much larger gain going to workers and a lower amount of the gain going to people at the very top. So there's no necessity behind what's happened in the United States. But what has happened is unlikely to change without some real change in public policy. And what we've seen over the last few decades is a real shift in our public policy towards favoring people at the top.
Why? Why have we let that happen, do you think?
Well, part of it is it becomes very self-reinforcing in the sense that the more people have, the more political power they gain the more money they have, right? When with Citizens United, the ability to spend that money politically, and they're able to turn that back around into more political power. So it will take quite a bit of effort and mobilization to really change that overall dynamic. And it's important that people understand that that has a big impact on our democracy and our society going forward.
Mm-hmm. Could a state or could the federal government have a law that would say you cannot have this 300-1 disparity? It can be no more than, 100-1, which also seems like a lot. But could that be put into law?
Well, you could have tax rules to that effect. I mean, remember, we used to have, under the Eisenhower administration, when our country was growing very rapidly, you had very high top income tax brackets. And what happened is as the top income tax brackets were cut, it became more and more profitable to gain the higher wages at the top. And not only that, we've had the cutbacks in capital gains tax to where it's a better deal in terms of taxes, to have earnings off of investments rather than earnings off of income. And again, that creates a certain set of incentives around executive compensation. So there's no reason you couldn't, in the tax code, say either increase the taxes at the top or say there'll be higher corporate taxes if those ratios are out of whack. Now, what's difficult there is what do you count as an employee? Because one of the things that's driving this push to more low-wage jobs is outsourcing. And that generally within a corporation, you have a certain set of, historically, there were a certain set of norms where people could have the same occupation with the same skills required, but if you were at a higher earning industry, you would actually earn more money. And what's happened over the years is lots of those kinds of jobs have been outsourced. Janitors, security guards, et cetera. In our airports around the country, we had a very large amount of outsourcing of jobs that used to be done directly by airlines, so the baggage handlers, airplane fuelers, airplane cleaners. And as those jobs were outsourced, the wages plummeted. So you've got these contractors coming in and paying much lower wages than than were paid previously. So it's a little difficult to do just within the firm. A long way of saying that, but there's clearly our tax policies could address this issue of high CEO compensation.
We open the conversation to our listeners, and we'll do that in a moment. We're talking about a number of issues. There's a new study by the Berkeley Center for Labor Research showing that nearly three quarters of U.S. households use public assistance programs that use them are headed by somebody who is working. Our guest has all kinds of information about low-wage workers, and you would be surprised what industries some of them are in. The productivity of the American worker increasing, but the wages not increasing at all. What's happened to unions in this country, the gap between those who have quite a bit in this country and those who don't have, and how it's 300-1, which is pretty substantial in America. Should we have policies in place that address that? Should we be doing more, much more, in terms of helping people who are in low-wage jobs, jobs like home health care, an industry that's going to be exploding as everybody gets old in this country, child care workers, bank tellers, people who are lecturing at universities who may have PhDs who are low-wage workers, and many of them are on food stamps? Is there something wrong here, and is there a way in your mind to make it better? Make it more equitable. Our guest is Ken Jacobs, chair of the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. He's been a labor specialist for a number of years, and his areas include health care coverage, the California budget, low-wage work, the retail industry, and public policy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We always welcome your comments on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. Ken Jacobs is our guest. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We have one line open for you to join the conversation. Gary in Madison is first. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. I agree with you, Kathleen, and your guests that wages need to be increased. But whenever we talk about this, we start bashing Walmart. You know, and I'm just fed up with that. I walk into Walmart, and I see a little girl with a twisted body in a wheelchair, but she's got a big smile on her face. I mean, you almost have to look away. There's nowhere else on earth that that little girl could get a job. They employ people that no one else will. In addition to that, if you live in Lancaster, Wisconsin, and you've got four kids and you got to get them ready for school, there's nowhere else that you can get prices that you can at Walmart. And take the time sometime just to Google Walmart's charities. They're not as bad as you think. In fact, they're quite altruistic. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, Gary. Thanks for the call. Ken.
Sure. Walmart obviously stands in for a lot of what's happening today, in part because they're the largest employer in America and mm-hmm. the largest in the world, but also because they really developed a low-wage strategy, which they relentlessly pushed. And there is very good evidence that as Walmart expanded out of Bentonville, their low-wage strategy drove down wages throughout the retail industry as other firms, other retailers sought to compete with Walmart, but also that as Walmart expanded, the number of jobs in retail was reduced, not increased. So it's important, there's this idea that Walmart, well, at least they're creating jobs. If you look at their expansion, in fact, the opposite in the retail industry is true. It's also the case, yes, Walmart's prices are low, but they would still could still have low prices if they raised wages. And this is one of the issues we looked at very directly. And were Walmart to raise their wages to $12, $13 an hour, $13 an hour would be enough so a family of two didn't need food stamps, the impact on prices would just be minuscule. And so you'd have a very, very small impact on prices, a penny on a box of macaroni and cheese. But the gain on that would be that a large number of workers wouldn't earn enough to get by. And survive and support their families. And I think many people think that would be a very good trade-off.
Well, as I understand it, it has had profound ripple effects all across the economy, right? So people who are supplying Walmart are also, their wages are going down because they have to supply the product to Walmart for something that's pretty inexpensive. So what they can sell them a lot, but they're not going to make as much money.
Well, it's also true on the manufacturing side that Walmart has been relentless in pushing that its suppliers also to lower cost, which has also pushed down wages as well. And of course, in terms of the push to bring more and more things in from China and elsewhere, so and then within there to relentlessly push down wages. So yes, they've had a broader impact on the overall economy, and one which really has been part of an important part of the story of the driving down wages in America.
Rich in Rhinelander is next. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Thank you for having Ken Jacobs on. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'd like to make just one fast comment about the previous caller with Walmart, in that in addition to all the things that Ken just mentioned, what Walmart has done is externalized some of their costs to the taxpayer in the form of subsidies such as food stamps. And the idea that the Walton heirs are worth, I don't know, $40 billion or whatever collectively, the five of them, at the same time the employees can't simply put food on the table without public assistance is somewhat abhorrent. And I think that's something that the caller has to understand, is that, you know, this idea of trickle-down economics that just give people at the top all these advantages and all that will somehow fall down to the average worker is simply not played out over the last 30 years. But the other reason that I called is just I'd like the Ken to comment on this idea of mine, is that prior to the Great Depression, you know, there was a inequality that was well known. There was very wealthy people and very poor people, not much of a middle class. And then post-World War II, New Deal, there emerged this emergent middle class, and then consequently you mentioned about trade unionism, and this was all sort of accepted. But then in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan came along and said, well, the problem isn't that there's, you know, very wealthy people that had too much money and too much political power in the past. The problem is government. Government's the problem. We just have to get rid of taxes and free very wealthy people from the shackles of regulation and bad tax policy, higher taxes on their marginal income. And I'd just be interested to know whether he agrees with my idea that changed the public idea of what was wrong with our economy, and that it wasn't that there was income inequality prior to the Great Depression and all the bad things that happened there, but rather that now it's government is what's shackling the entrepreneurial spirit of very wealthy people.
Ken?
I think that's exactly right. What with Ronald Reagan and the conservative movement at the time that helped elect him to the presidency, that we've had a real... We had a real sea change in how people view the economy, and this belief that the problem was, you know, Reagan famously saying that the problem is government. And that, I think, is both profoundly wrong and has helped lead to the direction that we've gone in. That if we look at successful economies around the world, government has an important role to play in upholding standards, in ensuring that there are both labor standards, environmental standards, the broad sort of regulation that creates a society worth living in, investing in infrastructure, which is important in order for an economy to grow, and that we've just, in slashing that back, especially on the regulatory side under Reagan, and then subsequent presidents, has had a very long-term negative effect on our economy and on both low and middle-income workers in our country.
Thank you very much, Rick, for your call. Alan in Madison, hi.
Yes, thanks. Have there been other times in history where there has been this much economic inequality? And the second part is this kind of inequality a natural outgrowth of a capitalistic economic system?
Thanks, Alan.
Well, those are two very large questions. The answer to the first one, of course, is yes. And in the United States, 1929, before the stock market crash, we had levels of inequality similar to what we see today. If you go back farther in history, there were very high levels of economic inequality worldwide. On the question of is this a natural outgrowth of the capitalist system, I think there's a real there's some real debates on that in terms of, you know, Piketty's recent book, of course, would argue that the period between the Second World War and the 1970s was an aberration, or even really the First World War in the 1970s was an aberration in terms of reduction of the income inequality, and that the normal state is one that pushes us to higher levels of income inequality. I think as we look at the evidence that institutional factors really matter, that if you have a state that is capable of and putting in regulation, tax policy, policy enabling unionization, that in fact you can reduce income inequality. And we saw that through those institutional factors for an important part of the last century. And that as that eroded, we've seen economic inequality increase. So I don't think there's anything guaranteed or natural about what's happened. I think it really is a matter of decisions and of public policy and of societal norms.
Ken, what do you think would be a fair minimum wage price? If you had two people in a family working, mom and dad were working, and you had two children, what would you need to get by on?
Well, that really depends on the local economy, and that number
right.
varies. You know, in a place like San Francisco, where I live, for a single individual, you need over 17, and for a family of four, you need quite a bit more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be different in other parts of the country. That leads to this question of what should the minimum wage be? And the new bill put forward the most recent bill put forward in Congress would raise the national minimum wage to $12 an hour. I think that would be appropriate, and it would put the ratio of the minimum wage to the median wage, which is a measure that economists use looking at the minimum wage, back to where it was in the United States in 1968. So I think that would be a important advance in the U.S. as a whole, and then in particular cities and states, the minimum wage should be increased in line with both cost of living and the economic capacity of that state to work within that higher minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alan, for your call. Samantha in Door County. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I live in a tourist county here, and most of the people that I work with, I am only working part-time. And most of my coworkers are also working part-time, and I work in childcare. And obviously, you stated about the wage of what we get paid. And some of us are even needing to get our college degree to continue in this field. In a town that dies in the winter, it's really common for everyone up here to become laid off. And it seems to me that without programs that help pay for childcare and such, you would end up not even being able to employ these people because they couldn't afford child care. So I wonder, when I look at a gentleman like Dan Price, who owns Gravity Payments in Seattle, a millionaire, who decides to cut his wage down to $70,000 a year and then bring all of his employees up to, I think it was almost like $22,000 a year, so that they were making the same amount. I see a big-hearted trend happening here, particularly out west. I'm hoping it comes east, for employers to really care about the financial issues that their employees are dealing with and to respond to it rather than continue to become greedily wealthy.
I wish I shared your optimism. I think that one of the reasons I was so struck by the story, Samantha, is I couldn't believe somebody was doing this. You know, it seemed like it was a really good thing to do, and it made the news because there aren't many such stories, or maybe it's a growing trend. I'm not aware of it. Ken, are you?
I have not heard that this as being a growing trend, and I'm a little skeptical about what will happen on a voluntary basis versus changing policy overall. I think it's a very positive development in terms of demonstrating how things could, in fact, change. But I just want to get back to the comments the caller made. I mean, I really want to commend you on work in childcare. This is an industry that is vitally important to our country's well-being and to our overall economy, and we incredibly underinvest in childcare.
We sure do.
Childcare wages are low and have been low for a long period of time. I think that's largely because it's a heavily female occupation, or that's one of the reasons that going there. But it's an occupation that's right. The educational demands are going up. And there's very good evidence that the wages paid in childcare are highly correlated with outcomes of those childcare facilities, that it matters in terms of turnover, and it matters in terms of the amount of stress the childcare teacher is under, which also gets translated to the children. Overall, we need to raise wages for childcare workers, and that means higher public subsidies. There's no two ways about it. I think what you said is absolutely right. It's many of the people who have childcare assistance could not afford to pay more towards childcare, and that means we really have to be thinking about universal childcare, universal pre-K, rolling things into our school systems, increasing subsidies, so that in fact we have the supports in place so that people can work, and that childcare teachers can get paid commensurate with the benefit that they bring to our society.
And it's been a problem, Ken, for a long time. You think one of the major changes of the last century was women entering the workforce in huge numbers, and I think for the most part they're still in charge of figuring out the child care arrangements, and they're working, and their wages aren't keeping up with where they ought to be, and so they're trying to find decent child care and don't have much of an income themselves. So the whole system is pretty messed up, and it really creates stress for everybody, I think.
That is absolutely right. This has impacts on the workers, has impacts on the children, on the families. The ability for parents to find quality child care is
very hard.
An impact on their own income, mm-hmm. and their own stability at work, because if they have trouble holding on to the child care provider and have to miss work, that can affect both their ability to advance in their work, but also the ability to retain employment. So the impacts on the economy and on workers' well-being is multidimensional, and we've just historically way underinvested in an area that is so important.
Why? I don't understand that. I don't understand why we haven't moved forward on that.
Well, I think it does have a lot to do with what you said in the lead-in comment there, that this is work that was traditionally done by women in the household, and I think that is one of the reasons why it is heavily undervalued. And the same would be true with home care work, that that sort of work that it was seen as having a domestic role and seen as women's work has never been treated with the respect and dignity that is due that work, given the importance of the work for society as
mm-hmm.
a whole.
And when you see what's involved, you know how important the work is. All you have to do is need the service, and you know. Thanks, Samantha, for the call. Be sure and listen to tomorrow's 1 o'clock, where some of your comments will be discussed for the full hour. Naomi in Madison, hi.
Hi. Along the same lines that you guys were just talking about, I think when we look at other countries who have a much lower rate of poverty, a much higher rate of just economic stability throughout their, you know, citizenship, whether that's low-wage workers or not, we see services being the main staple that keep people stable. And I think child care is a big one, but I think we also don't talk about health care enough. Health care is one of the biggest causes of bankruptcy in this country. And so while raising people's wages is a good thing, and we need to do that, you know, one unexpected illness, even for people who now have this mandated insurance company, can wipe out a person's life savings, can wipe out any sort of nest egg that they had to keep them safe and stable, because we don't have national health insurance here, whereas other more social countries like France, like Britain, like Canada, that do provide national health insurance don't see that same instability in their workforce.
Mm-hmm. Healthcare is right up your alley, isn't it, Ken?
It is, and mm-hmm. I'd say that is absolutely correct. And the one big bright spot that we have seen in recent years in addressing the kinds of issues we're talking about was the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the fact that we now have millions more people who have coverage either through Medicaid in those states that did do the Medicaid expansion and through the exchanges. The health insurance exchanges has really made a tremendous difference. And one can argue, I think our system is still too fragmented. There are major problems in terms of costs and maintaining, keeping costs down. But at the same time, there's no question that the expansion has just had a very large impact on strengthening that safety net for working families.
Let's go to Ben next in Madison. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a general comment here. I'm a longtime NPR listener. I think you probably know from your own statistics that NPR listeners are probably better educated and more informed than your average person. You've had a lot of good discussions on like this, a lot of them pointing to holes in our dysfunctional system. The problem I see, though, is that we're listening and we care, but our policymakers really don't. There's this issue, and there's dozens more where I listen, I hear, I acknowledge, and callers call in to make points, and the guest usually says, oh, you're absolutely right, and we have all these facts to back that up. When it comes to policy being made, it's not being made based on those facts. It's not being made based on the experience of people who are less than wealthy or can't afford to kind of advocate for themselves in our political system. So I keep listening occasionally, but I feel like there's a huge disconnect between what you're talking about and what people experience and the actual policies that get made regarding it.
And why do you think that is? Why is policy so different? And what effect can just normal people have, do you think, Ben, on policy?
Well, I'm going to blame the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is campaign finance.
Mm-hmm.
You have folks like the Koch brothers contributing to Walker's campaign, and of course the Democrats do this as well. But right now you have the people with the money are really pushing and driving the rules. They also have really good PR, which is something that I want to say that the left or even just sort of centrist common sense ideas like paying child care workers better and paying more attention to these kinds of issues that the left and the sort of centrist things don't have. So the PR is good. People go to the polls, they vote against their interests because they've been duped. Just like I see people at the grocery store buying 24 packs of bottled water, which is not as clean as what comes out of their tap. So they've been convinced to do something that is great for the people convincing them and not good for them.
Hmm. Well, in a way, all of this is, I think what he says is very true, but some of these issues really don't have political dimensions, or they shouldn't, should they, Ken? I mean, people, child care workers making a decent wage, home health care workers, college-educated instructors, everybody for that matter. Why in the world should that become a political issue?
Well, we're living at a time where almost everything's become a political issue. I mean, one of the things that, and I understand being where you are in Wisconsin right now, it's you've definitely taken knocks in recent years in all of these dimensions in a very large way. I do think it's important to note that on issues like the minimum wage, there's incredible support among Democrats, among Republicans, among independents. When minimum wage was put on the ballot last fall, we saw we saw support in the reddest of red states.
Mm-hmm.
These issues, when you break it down to the actual issues, you can find very broad support. And so part of that challenge is organizing that support in a way that allows you to make change. And now that's easier in states where you have access to ballot initiative as a way to do things or have a government that is more representative in that way. But one of the things that has given me hope in recent years is watching what's been happening with the fast food worker organizing and the Walmart worker organizing. These workers really taking an incredibly courageous stance of going out and doing these strikes, and they've really raised the issue of low-wage work in a way we haven't seen in a very long time in the United States, and have really done it in a palpable way. And in doing so, they've not only changed the perception of what is necessary for people to get by, but also what is possible. And if you had told me just a few years ago that we'd be looking at $15 minimum wages in San Francisco and Seattle and $13 in Chicago, I would have thought you were crazy. And yet, by all these workers going out and acting together, they really have had a big impact in changing that sense of what's possible.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about this hour. Nearly three-quarters of people helped by programs that are geared to the poor are members of a family headed by a worker, according to this new study by the Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education at the University of California. Taxpayers are providing not only support to the poor, but also a huge subsidy for employers of low-wage workers. Our guest is Ken Jacobs, and he is at that Berkeley Center for Labor Research. We're welcoming your phone calls. Ben, thanks very much for your thoughtful comments. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll be back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Inshano writes this, could you address an even uglier facet of this trend, that of prison labor, known as federal prison industries, the outsourcing of prisoners for as little as 23 cents an hour, manufacturing military uniforms, electronics, and furniture? Ken?
That is another aspect of lowering wages, and there's a whole longer conversation turns around all the issues around mass incarceration, not only the question of prison labor, but also the question of the ability for people who have been formally incarcerated to find jobs and to hold on to jobs. So, and as we've seen in the recent piece in the New York Times, just what a large share of, especially in the African American men, that affects, and what that has very long-term economic impacts on people's ability to earn decent wages.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Bryce in Ellsworth. Hi, Bryce.
Oh.
Hi.
I had a question that I've never really heard any discussion on. Since World War II, women have been entering the workforce in greater numbers. Now it's, about even with men. And, the number of consumers, percentage-wise, hasn't really changed significantly, but the number of workers has almost doubled. That has to have some significant impact on wages and the economy in general, and I've never really heard any discussion on that. I was very interested to hear your thoughts.
Well, one aspect of this is, when we look at it, we see stagnating and declining real wages. The main gains in family income that we saw in the 1970s and 1980s were almost entirely to increase in work hours. So what happened is we had more and more women came into the workforce, and they were able, by adding to the work, to help families stay ahead, but again, not get far ahead. In other words, when we look at all of the gains in income, it's not from increased wages. The real wages have gone down. It's from increased work hours, or mainly, that is, women entering the workforce. And we've gone about as far as we're going to get in that vein, and so now other measures are going to be needed if we're going to actually get family incomes to rise.
Jerry in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Hi. The longer I listen, the harder I have to agree with what you're saying, Ken. But I was in management and an owner of business manufacturing. And one of the things that I see is that we need to have, I think, better education, not generally, but in time, places of leadership. When I had a business, one of the things I found that if I paid more money, I got better workers. And what that did, unfortunately, was meant that the people who were not willing to work hard or weren't skilled enough were left to lower paying jobs. And then the other thing that I think we need to think about or realize is that productivity is not
the result of people not working harder or smarter, or, you know, productivity is how much you produce per hour, but that automation and robotics and many other factors have contributed to higher productivity, and that has made it look like we're actually going down rather than going up. So I think if we educated industry and educated the producers, the leadership, that they could benefit by having a better paid, a better educated, and a better supported workforce, that they would actually be have a better company.
Ken.
Yeah, well, they're absolutely, in the evidence is extremely strong on this, that when you raise wages, and we can see this from minimum wage and various other programs, worker turnover goes down. That brings savings to employers. Work performance improves, less absenteeism, fewer grievances, better customer service, et cetera. So there really is a benefit to paying higher wages. I do think it's important to note around on the education side of this is this education and worker training is very important, and groups like the Center on Wisconsin Strategies there where you are have just done phenomenal work in this area and in all the areas that we're discussing today. It's also important to note that we can't educate our way out of this problem, that real wages for people with a bachelor's degree or higher have fallen in the last decade. We talked about the fact that one quarter of adjunct professors mm-hmm. are in families on public assistance, that while education is very important, the problem is deeper and more structural, and so it's one part of the solution, but it's clearly not going to solve the problem overall. And just on the notion of about automation and robots, automation could go in many different directions. And one of the recent studies that the Center on Wisconsin Strategies worked on looked at this very question. One could imagine if you increase productivity, if it all goes to the top, that gives you one set of outcomes. And if it's distributed more evenly, it gives you another set of outcomes. And that's not something that just happens on its own. It's a question of what are our public policies around that. So the problem isn't automation. It's what's the distribution of the outcome of that increase in productivity.
Charlie is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to say, as a conservative, how is this not a rallying cry to the conservative political base? Simply because without the corporate welfare that we are supplying people, we're increasing our debt and hurting our country. Shouldn't this be a conservative issue to give people a livable wage so that there is less corporate welfare and less drain on the country's finances as well as a bloating of the government? Thank you.
Thanks, Charlie.
Great question. And in fact, that is something we have seen recently in California. Conservative businessman Ron Unz proposed a $12 minimum wage on that very basis. Even Bill O'Reilly said he has no problem with increasing the minimum wage for that same reason, that it would decrease the need for people to rely on public assistance. So, yes, there is a strong conservative argument there. Of course, I want to be very clear that public assistance programs are vitally important. They provide an essential safety net, and if we increase the minimum wage, if we take steps to raise wages, then we can better target the use of those funds so we can do things like expanding child care and increasing the pay of child care workers.
Ken, thank you very much for being with us. We could talk for such a long time. It will be interesting to see what happens in the next few years, particularly how this issue is going to be addressed. And it will be finally pretty much front and center, I think, in the presidential race.
I think it will be.
I think you're right. Thanks,
Thank
Ken.
You.
Thank you. Ken Jacobs, our guest this hour, chair of the Labor Center. It's the Berkeley Center for Labor Research at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And we thank him for being with us. He's been labor specialist there for a number of years and is particularly interested in healthcare coverage, California budget, low-wage work, retail industry, and public policy. I'm sorry we were jammed with messages and phone calls. We'll be on this issue again, I guarantee you. So we hope you'll contact us again next time. And just a reminder, tomorrow we are speaking with Dan Price, the Seattle business owner who decided to cut his salary by a huge amount and double the salary of his employees to $70,000. Which is a pretty amazing story. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show, Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee.